This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. But don't expect us to be nice or politically correct. Nothing is sacred, and the team will be finding the queer and profane wherever we can on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
The word is about, there's something evolving.
And I'm Jim, and there's Kurt, James, and Steph, our original team, back in the studio tonight.
Hello,
welcome, guys.
Hi, Jim.
G'day, Jim.
Hi, Steph. Hi, Kurt. And hi, James, who hasn't got a microphone.
He doesn't have a microphone. That's a bit mean. Hi, James.
Silence.
We are sharing microphones at the moment.
I'll jump on later.
And we've got an interesting show tonight. We're going to be talking about a diverse range of things that ranges from foster care through nuclear power, climate change, and with an interview that Steph has done with a physicist, and some discussion about the results of the child abuse report's findings from the state government or the state parliament's inquiry into child abuse. So we've got a few things to talk about, and then we'll have a bit of a chat about what we're going to do for our 20th anniversary show, which is next week. We'll be having some guests in the studio for that. And if you go to our Facebook page, that is Facebook/isnothingsacred on Joy 94.9, you can leave us a message on there, or you can leave us a message on air at joy.org.au if you're on your computer and you want to email in, or you can text us on 0427 joy 949.
Is Nothing Sacred with Pat, James, Kurt, and Steph, Joy 94.9.
Good evening, everybody. You're on Joy 94.9 on Is Nothing Sacred, as you just heard Pat saying there. That's going to be his contribution for tonight, because Pat's got the night off tonight, and I'm sure he's listening. Hello, Pat. And we're going to be talking, first of all, with Kurt's going to talk to us about foster care. So off you go, Kurt, but I hope this has got some factual base to it, because if it hasn't, I'm going to have to get cross.
Cross? How scary, Jim. Yeah, there's factual base, of course. I want to address the fact that there's a bit of a crisis going on in our foster care system at the moment, with the number of carers for children who have been removed from their families is in decline. So
you mean the number of carers is in decline, not the number of children being removed from families?
Is that what I said? I don't know. Well, I don't know what came out just then. But so the foster care system is basically been unchanged for at least a century, and it's sort of still the same old thing, whereas we're sort of getting a lot more children who need foster carers, and there's not enough foster carers out there, just because certain types of people like the LGBTI community are being turned away. Single parents are being turned away, and they're just sort of, you know, not looking at sort of everybody who wants to be a parent. They're only looking at certain.
But a lot of those foster care organisations still advertising on Joy, or being sponsoring Joy, asking for LGBTI foster carers.
A lot's changing at the moment. The New South Wales government has actually, the New South Wales cabinet has just approved the reformation of the state's adoption laws, which will be introduced into Parliament by the end of the year, which is called an open adoption. So under an open adoption, the legal responsibility for the child is transferred from the state to the adoptive parents, and the child's birth parents, siblings and extended family have contact, as opposed to the more common process of a closed adoption. And what I really wanted to get at today was sort of why we're finding we've got a lot of foster children, and the reasons behind why they're being removed from their biological parents, and why don't we sort of address those issues rather than just, you know, get more.
Well, they're being removed from their biological parents because there's not a license to breed.
That's what I was thinking, Jim. Because there's some way we can stop these people breeding. You know, like the main reasons.
Well, that's actually called eugenics, and it's not a really nice thing.
It should, you know, you should be. You have to get a license or do a course or something before having a child.
I feel like I should interject and say, Joy 94.9 does not condone eugenics. I think perhaps we're condoning contraception. I'd say,
yes.
And maybe that's the end.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thanks, I mean, the problem with eugenics is that you have to actually have a trusted group of people to decide. And,
yeah.
You know, who are you going to give that to? The elected politicians?
Exactly.
Our bunch, surely.
Yeah. Campbell Newman.
Oh, terrific.
But what about, like, what about halfway in between, though, then? Like, if they've had, they've had the child and they're not prepared or they're not good parents, then there must be other things that can be done in terms of preventing the next, you know, at full-on adoption rather than...
Yeah, exactly.
I remember we talked about this on a really early show that we had, and I expressed my view then, which I had from work that I'd done when I was in New South Wales, because the New South Wales laws will not flow through to anyone else because this is a specifically state issue.
Yep.
And I've always been hard line about this. I think that if people do not protect their children and that children are victims of child abuse in the home as opposed to externally, because people can't always protect their children externally. I mean,
yep.
They don't know when Catholic priests are doing it or
yep.
teachers.
Yep.
But they do know often if it's happening at home. And for those, I don't think there should be any take the kids away and put them in foster care and then try and rehabilitate them with their parents, because one of the awful things about abuse is that once it starts, it doesn't stop. It's one of those things that it's very, very hard to, the evidence tells us, to actually cure people of the desire to abuse.
Yep.
So I think we ought to be going straight for adoption.
Yep.
And actually saying, as soon as a child is abused, if it's assessed as being abused, let's put it up for adoption to people who want to adopt, and then open the adoptions up to all sorts of people. So gays and lesbians should be able to adopt.
Yep. And single parents
yep. if they need to. As long yep. as there are good protections in place for those children. And as long as, and the one thing I do think that we should do, I think the notion that New South Wales proposed legislation about open adoptions where the children are then able to maintain contact with their biological siblings mm-hmm. is actually really important, and that
it
should
is.
Be encouraged.
Yeah, it is.
And as much as possible, people should be encouraged to adopt siblings.
Yeah.
You know, to adopt a whole family in one go, if that's
yeah.
if that's the best
yeah.
way to go.
But what about, Jim, like that could be just in circumstances of abuse. What about circumstances of mental illness or substance abuse? Like, you know, is there more that we can do to prevent, you know, someone to help?
You know, I was involved in a case once where there was a substance abuse issue going on, and the problem basically is the evidence for women who are mothers and heroin users is that they don't look after their children any worse than generally mothers don't.
Mm.
And so often they would, where this big study was done in Southwest Sydney, where the women, before they would go off and have a hit, they would go and find a babysitter for their kids. They wouldn't just leave their kids in a pram outside
yeah.
a shop
yeah.
or any of those sorts of things, which was the myth. The myth was, oh, these yeah. mothers just leave their kids and then they go off and you know, go to the land of Nod, which is what happens to you when you shoot up.
Mm.
And they just weren't doing that. That's what the study showed. So I think we should be very careful about stigmatizing people because they've got a drug habit or
yep.
but for a mental illness. I mean, many people struggle to live their lives in a personally responsible way in a system that is not actually designed and doesn't support them to be responsible.
Yeah.
And that's what we should be doing, is looking at the system to make sure that the right supports are there for parents, particularly young parents, and to make sure that they can go and access services that provide them with assistance to be good parents.
Yeah.
I mean, most people want to be good parents. Most people don't want it. Most people don't have children with the express view of being a bad parent. So what else have you got to say about that, Kurt?
I just wanted to...
What are you going to outrage me with next?
Well, Jim, like you were saying about the parent who, you know, shoots up on heroin, wouldn't that sort of also... Like, the child would be seeing that kind of thing and then grow up to sort of think it's normal to go off and go to the land of Nod and, you know, don't you think there's sort of prospects...
Well, that depends whether the parents do it in front of their children or whether they make arrangements for their children to not be there when they shoot up.
Yeah.
I mean, just as bad as the fact that people smoke in front of their children and they drink in front of them like it's going out of style and they eat fast food in front of their children, which is even worse, and they feed fast food to their children, which I think is even worse.
It's all relative. It's all a drug, isn't it? Yeah. Because there's almost 20,000 Australian kids are living in foster care at the moment. It's okay for single parents to go for it and, you know, what... They're sort of opening up to it, so anyone can kind of adopt now. Do you think that's safe?
I don't see why it's not. I think that just depends on the system that you put around. All these things should be based on good systems approaches.
Yeah.
And we should have good studies and good evidence to tell us what is the best way to go and what is the safest thing for the child. And then we should put into place a system that enables those children to live safely. That's the most important thing as far as I can see for any community.
Yeah.
And I don't see what the marital status or the sexuality of a proposed parent is. Got anything to do with it, including whether they're having the children naturally or whether they're adopting them. I just don't think it matters.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, one day I'll get my children on here to tell you all what a fabulous father I was.
Maybe they could come in for the party.
Maybe they could.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
We are back on Joy 94.9 on Is Nothing Sacred. It's 10:25 and we've just had a bit of a discussion with Kurt about foster care, and now we're going to talk about something entirely different, nuclear power. And Steph, during the week, has done an interview with Luke Weston, who's a physicist, and she's going to take us to that interview.
Yeah, I was interested. I saw a couple of articles in the last week about the decommissioning of the Fukushima nuclear power station in Japan, and I was interested in knowing that people were quite concerned about the process and the risk of radiation to people and also to the environment around the area, and even reports as far as America. And so I thought, with the inquiring mind that we all have, I want to find out a physicist's view on the matter. So we have this interview with Luke Weston. Tonight we're talking to Luke Weston, who is a physicist here in Melbourne. Hello, Luke.
Hi, Steph. Great to be here.
Thanks very much for coming along. Now, there's been a lot of articles recently, some alarming articles I've read about the decommissioning of the Fukushima power plant. And some of the articles are expressing some concern about the environmental impact of the decommissioning that's been going on in the last couple of years, and a particularly risky bit coming up now, according to the articles, and also the impact of radiation on people. Can you tell our listeners about some of the risks associated with being exposed to radiation?
Sure. So basically, ionizing radiation, which is the kind of radiation that we're talking about here that comes from radioactive nuclei, is very high energy radiation. And when that hits cells in your body or in a living thing, it can do things like break apart molecules and break DNA molecules. And that's bad because it interferes with the ability of cells to reproduce, and it can cause things like cancer in some cases if that damage to DNA overwhelms the DNA repair machinery in the cells and overwhelms the ability that the organism has to correct that DNA damage. Then that can cause serious effects. That's really well known at high doses of radiation. At high radiological doses, it's universally accepted that ionizing radiation is really bad for you. At really small doses, that's not quite so well established, but everyone pretty much understands that lots of radiological dose is really bad for your health in general.
So one of the articles I was reading was talking about some animal life as well. There was an increase, they said, in the number of, I think, marine animals, seals and penguins. Could radiation theoretically have an impact on these animals as well?
Certainly, theoretically, if animals are exposed to enough radiological dose, they can have serious health effects, the same sort of health effects that we see in humans. Interestingly, if we look, for example, if we look at Chernobyl, in the exclusion zone around Chernobyl, we see lots of thriving wildlife. And the wildlife doesn't really seem to show that much in the way of adverse health effects. Obviously, some animals do develop cancer and some animals do die when they're exposed to a very high radiological dose. But in the context of a situation like Chernobyl, you have this environment full of animals where all the people have been evacuated, most of the people, actually, not all the people, and there's no human impact, and that actually seems to allow a lot of wildlife to thrive. And in the context of animals, it's also interesting because animals are subject to physiological health damage from radiation in the same way that people are, but they're not subject to fear and tabloid media influence and activism and these sort of social, psychological, emotional factors which are quite significant when we're talking about this issue.
So do you think that could be suggesting that the scale of damage in terms of the distance from the site at Chernobyl has been, we've been too cautious in terms of the size of the area that's been evacuated? Are you saying that maybe people could be resettling back in those areas that are now thriving?
Maybe. Certainly there was a very significant radiological release at Chernobyl. It was one of the most serious nuclear accidents in history, probably the most serious. And certainly it makes sense to evacuate people from some areas there. There are some people in that exclusion zone that still live there. They've refused to evacuate, and they seem to be living healthy, happy lives. One of the things that we've seen at Chernobyl, which is well documented in the United Nations Chernobyl Forum data, is that psychological health effects and stress and depression and mental health issues are really, really significant, more significant than the actual radiobiological damage that people have suffered. And that's really an interesting issue because, unfortunately, we're seeing exactly the same issues starting to emerge at Fukushima.
So a lot of the negative impacts, or some of them, the psychological ones, might be made worse by some of these tabloid media stories that we've been seeing, perhaps.
I think that's absolutely a very serious point. I think it's very likely. We see tabloid media and we see the media whipping up fear and uncertainty and doubt to sell newspapers and sell, you know, media ratings and whatnot. And we also see some of the really shrill, really ideological anti-nuclear power activists whipping up emotional scare stories, and I think that contributes a lot to the mental health impact as well.
I was listening to another radio show actually last week, and one of the listeners called up and was asking about the impact for Australians, potential risks. He'd heard something that America might be affected by the decommissioning of the power plant, and had sort of come to the conclusion himself that if America's at risk, maybe Australia is too. What kind of risk do you think there is for Australians in this process that's happening now in Japan?
I would say risk in terms of radioactivity, in terms of radiation exposure for anybody outside Japan is absolutely zero. I'd say the biggest risk that we face outside of the immediate vicinity of the plant at Fukushima is the risk that we face from burning a heap of oil and coal to replace nuclear power, which is what we're doing in Japan at the moment. Is we're burning a heap of extra coal and oil to replace nuclear power plants. Most of those nuclear power plants are actually completely intact, normally functioning, ready to go, shuttered mostly for political reasons, which is really unfortunate.
It's an issue I find interesting from, I guess, a climate change perspective, because nuclear power, from what I understand, has quite, using it as a source of energy, it has quite a small effect on greenhouse gases. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a clean source of energy that's free of greenhouse gas emissions. Obviously, as with anything like solar power or wind power, when you look at whole of life cycle analysis, there's a very tiny amount of greenhouse gas emission effectively if you look at constructing all the materials and things. And for nuclear power, it's non-zero, just like it's non-zero for wind or hydro or any technology. But it's, as with those technologies, it's effectively zero compared to fossil fuels.
Mm.
And it's an environmentally benign technology in actuality, and it's scalable, and it's a very dense technology. So it allows us to, let's say we're going to build one nuclear power plant and replace a coal power plant, and we have the same amount of energy available with the same reliability. So it allows us to really do that coal replacement, which is what we need to be doing, without huge amounts of land use.
But there's been quite a lot of backlash from the environmental movement, I guess, against nuclear power. And it is interesting to separate out that environmental issue in terms of, us assume it's uranium mining that people are opposed to, compared to the climate issue, where they're certainly not in line, it sounds like it. Something else I was wondering about, so just to put things in perspective, what are some of the sources of radiation that people might have in Australia in their day-to-day life? I guess people who are frightened of radiation, what might they already be exposed to?
Right, so I guess the majority of the background radiation that people are exposed to is natural radiation from radioactive materials in the earth, like thorium and radium and various things that occur in minerals in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
There are things like carbon-14 in the atmosphere that are produced by cosmic rays,
mm-hmm.
Potassium-40, which is in a lot of food and in a lot of normal tissue in living things, mm-hmm. And cosmic rays from space that come down through the atmosphere.
So if you're an astronaut, you might get a fair dose of radiation.
Yeah, you do get an elevated dose of radiation if you're an astronaut. If you go up on a normal passenger jet, you get a noticeably elevated dose of radiation. In fact, people who work as airline pilots and crews occupationally flying all the time get one of the highest occupational radiation doses of anybody in any occupation.
So given that we're exposed to radiation so frequently, why do you think there is so much nervousness about radiation and the exposure, especially as you were saying before, there's not a lot of evidence that at low doses it's a high risk?
Right. So why are people nervous about radiation? There's a lot of factors there at play. There's, I guess, because there's a lot of nuance to the technology. There's, science and technology, terminology and literacy can be quite complicated. There's the fear of nuclear weapons and the Cold War, and that's been very persuasive in the culture, that people are rightfully very concerned about nuclear weapons, and that kind of follows through and influences people's perception of other nuclear technology. Although I think nowadays, to some extent, with the younger generation, we're seeing people where that's less of an influence, because people are growing up at the tail end of the Cold War.
Yeah, right. So it's not just about the science, but also about the social context as well, and the media.
Yeah.
And the history, I guess.
Yeah, and it's also really interesting. If we look at Fukushima, for example, the damage to the nuclear reactors there is probably the only really significant nuclear power accident that we've had within the last 20 years or so, when we have this widespread public access to the internet and the World Wide Web and social media and stuff. And so that's had a really noticeable influence I've seen in discussions about Fukushima. In some ways it's positive, in some ways it's enabled good communication and science communication and stuff to be done, but also there's a lot of rubbish and conspiracy theories and inaccurate or outright fraudulent information that seems to circulate on Facebook and emails and websites and things.
Yeah, that's a bit concerning, I guess, the easy access of misinformation, making it harder to find out what the true information is.
Yeah, you know, Mark Twain said that a lie can go around the world while the truth is putting its boots on or something like that.
Yes, that doesn't surprise me at
very,
all.
It's a very apt statement in this situation.
Well, that's what we've got time for. Thanks so much for talking to us tonight. And I think you've given our listeners a lot to think about.
Thanks a lot, Steph. Great to be here.
Thanks.
You're on Joy 94.9 on Is Nothing Sacred. Steph, that was a great interview with your physicist mate, Luke Weston. And there were a couple of things that I would have pulled him up on, I think. The issue about nuclear power and safety and greenhouse emissions. I mean, I think it's fairly well known that there are no greenhouse emissions other than the building of the nuclear power plant, which creates quite massive massive greenhouse emissions. But there is the problem of waste storage and the ongoing potential exposure to people, to animals, to flora and fauna of waste storage, because there's no safe way yet of storing nuclear waste. And also we don't use nuclear fusion, we use nuclear fission, which means that it's a particularly dirty way of on a radioactive basis of creating the energy.
What do you mean by dirty?
In that it creates waste that is very, very harmful.
Yeah, certainly a contentious issue. I think this is something we're going to continue on our Facebook page. I can see James was listening very carefully and has a few opinions of his own.
You're with James, Kurt, Steph and Pat on Is Nothing Sacred? Joy 94.9.
We have had a message from Blair in Brunswick who says, does the panel think any real change is likely to come out of the recent inquiry into child sexual abuse by clergy? That's a good message for us tonight, Blair, because in fact it's one of the topics that we're going to talk about, and it's the one that James chose to talk about tonight. So, James, how are you going to answer Blair?
Oh, look, I'm so happy that Claire messaged in. Because
Blair of Brunswick.
I said Claire. God, I don't even... It's all right. Sorry, Blair.
We've probably seen Blair of Brunswick at one of those many trendy hipster cafes in Brunswick.
But back to the topic, because we haven't got all night. But there has been the first of the reports that have been brought out. So the Victorian inquiry has brought down their report,
which is a parliamentary inquiry, not to be confused with the Australian Government Royal Commission into child abuse.
Yeah, correct. And it's not as broad in any means, but I think it's a good start to see where the Royal Commission may head. Let's have a first look at what some of the recommendations are. If our listeners might remember, we did actually talk about particular issues that were being brought up while it was reporting, which was about the fact that there's an Ellis defence, which is about the fact that the church is not an incorporated entity, so it cannot be sued. That was one particular one, and one of the recommendations in it was that they wanted to dismantle such a defence, which would mean that they would need to, all religious organisations would need to be incorporated, and I think we went further and to say that any organisation that was, that had public funds or was, they needed to be covered under.
Well, all NGOs are already covered. Incorporated organisations, you cannot get government funding in any way for service delivery in any non-government organisation without being an incorporated association. Hmm. And there's very strong rules about that, which have been strengthened by the Napthine government since they've been in power, in fact. So if it's good enough for the community organisations, then it's good enough for the Catholic Church, surely.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still absolutely... I mean, although Victoria might have made words to go further, and we'll look at that in a sec, there is still a lot more room to move in other jurisdictions, particularly New South Wales and Queensland.
Well, it's one of these things that is state matter.
State-based, which is why it's great that there's the Royal Commission, which can be a more whole-of-Australia approach. There was also recommendations about including child... abuse in like excluding it, sorry, out of the statute of limitations in terms of you know, being beyond a period of time at which someone can be called to account for sexual abuse. Jim, you probably know more about your time frames, and you had an opinion on that. I know. There was also recommendations.
Of course, I do. I have an opinion on everything.
Creating an independent and an basically an alternative to a normal justice avenue for criminal child abuse victims. So something we know that one of the biggest problems for child sexual abuse is it's underreported and people don't, you know, often come forward until years and years after. So there needs to be, you know, specific organisations or jurisdictions set up that can deal with this in a very sensitive way.
You do have to be very, very careful about these sorts of things because there's this very discredited set of arrangements now called repressed memory therapy that people got into in a big way in a few years ago and turned out to be just nonsense, where certain therapists were digging memories out of adults' brains, adults who thought they might be victims of child sexual abuse, and then they'd suddenly have all these memories of being abused, and they'd start naming people, and they could never be corroborated, and a lot of them were shown under more intense counselling to be false memories that have been in fact planted in their minds by their therapists. So we need to be really careful about the unintended consequences of some of these things. But though I am very supportive of the notion of getting rid of the statute of limitations, as long as when we do these sorts of things, we again have a systematic approach to it. We look at what the evidence tells us. We go and we set up systems that support those people that may have been victims of child sexual abuse, even if it's coming up later in their life and creating significant psychological and psychiatric problems for them. Mm. We've already got enough problems in the mental health area and not enough services.
Absolutely. Well, and Steph, I'd be interested to see what you think. And then again, coming back to Blair in terms of her question, I think there's, from a political look at this, I think that it's already interesting to see, and I suppose a bit disheartening to see some of the responses from this interim report and what it bodes for the Royal Commission. Tony Abbott's defence, almost, is less than helpful.
Well, Tony Abbott jumped in and supported Cardinal Pell, who got fairly soundly criticised in the Victorian report, and when the media said to the Prime Minister, have you read the report? He said, no, but George Pell's a good man. So without actually reading the report and what they said about Pell's contribution, and the report actually says that the Catholic Church actually trivialised and made light of the issue, and they were overly legalistic in terms of the protection of them of themselves rather than the interests of the children who had been abused. And if George Pell was the Archbishop when that was going on, and that was under his leadership, then it's fairly disingenuous of the Prime Minister to jump in and say, "Oh, he's a good man," and I haven't read the report.
It doesn't bode well. However, Jim, like when we're actually talking about whether we think any of these will be acted on, I think that there is a very good chance, which is great to hear, the very good chance that in particular in Victoria, Napthine is giving good signals on a number of the recommendations. I think everyone heard his statement as we're going to act now, we're going to do all the recommendations. His actual words weren't quite that categorical. I have them here. They were, we will commence a immediately drafting legislation to implement a number of the key recommendations, and he's singling out and focusing particularly on the strengthening of laws. So he wants to include you know, hiding offence or shuffling child abuse.
So he's taking a law and order approach, of course, which is what politicians will always do.
Can I just jump in? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think so. Any recommendations that's been made in a parliamentary inquiry would have had to have been approved by the parliamentary committee, which comprises of members from both of the major parties. So with these recommendations already have support, maybe not from the parties as a whole, but certainly from members from both of the major parties. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the changes to be made. And I mean, it's been tabled in Parliament, so it is quite a high level document. And in terms of the legislative change, I wonder whether that's sort of a good starting point in the sense that it's something that can be implemented more quickly within Naphthene's control, because what's going to be happening next is that the recommendations will be, I guess, divvied up between the relevant departments who would then make their own government response. So I don't think we should take the first response as this is all we're doing. I think we should interpret it as this is what we're doing right now,
yeah,
and
hopefully.
I expect there'll be more to come.
And I think there's another aspect, and that is that it may give a pointer to the way in which politicians are thinking with regard to the National Royal Commission. And the National Royal Commission will in fact be cutting across a number of things which are similar, and one of those things will be the role of the new Australian National Council on Non-Government Organisations, which has just
yes.
been strengthened, and the national legislation on incorporated associations has also been strengthened in the last year.
Mm.
So there's quite a lot of room for manoeuvre in getting national complementary legislation. And that's something that things like this lead to those types of reforms where we get model laws. And, you know, you'll see the reforming lawyers starting to say, we want national model laws which every state enacts, so that the same acts of parliament go through every state parliament, and then people are treated the same way in every jurisdiction. And that's really what we want to see on things like this.
Absolutely. I mean, I hope we partly answer Blair's question. But just before we go, I mean, I suppose the main thing is that at least there is just so much interest now in these things, and it's fantastic to see that people are watching it. There certainly, I think, will be a lot of reform after this.
You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's now 10:56. We've almost wrapped up the show for tonight, and I think we've had some interesting discussions. We've gone from foster care to nuclear power and to the Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry.
Great chat today.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.